This is my second presentation. Last time we looked at the beginning chapters of Genesis dealing with the primeval world, looking at the entire world. Today we're going to take the rest of Genesis and begin to focus down. We'll see what happens here. It gradually moves from the whole world to patriarchs of a particular nation. So we're going to find that the channel of the story moves from the world to the nation. Eventually it'll move to a particular tribe, and it seems to have history heading someplace. Again, a reminder that what we're doing is the quick once-over. We're just taking a look for this portion of the class to see what the major themes are, to see what the major players are, to see what the key events are and the places and things like that, the history. Eventually we'll come back, we'll re-look at it more closely when it comes to literature and all, but we're just trying to see the players, see what's happening here. So we're going to take a look at little bits and pieces of the rest of Genesis, not all the chapters. There's a lot to cover, obviously. But we're going to start with Genesis 12. And this is where we begin to get that focus that I mentioned. It's short enough. That's okay. I'd like to read it. Genesis 12 starts, "The Lord had said to Abram," now this is going to be called, this person will be Abraham. Right now it's Abram. "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." Now, all of a sudden, in verse 2, I hope you can see it in your Bible, there's a switch here from prose to poetry. Now, remember what we said before about poetry. Something important, something elevated, something passionate, something important will be put into poetry. So we're going to see later on much of the prophecies, the major prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and people like that, they're going to shift to poetry as well for an elevated emotional output that they have. So here we have it in Genesis 12. The first one we saw was when Adam saw Eve for the first time. Wow, he said, this is good. This one's not a love poem. This is the first real covenant with Abraham we're going to see here. There's a second one we'll look at that's part of the same one. Verse 2, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So if you hear that refrain about blessings are coming, they're coming through Abraham, not necessarily to Abraham, although he did very well, but there's going to be something that will be blessed, the whole earth will be blessed because of something going through Abraham here, and he will become, as it says, a great nation. So two world religions, specifically Judaism and Islam, look back to Abraham as their father. And so here we get the start of that, being turned into a great nation. So this is a covenant, right? This is a promise that God has with Abraham. Again, do you notice Abraham basically has to do what God says? That's the role of Abraham. That's his part of the covenant. And God's part is to bless him, bless the nations that are on his side, and turn him into a great nation. So there it is. It's not like I mentioned before, it's like a contract, but unlike contracts, there are no end dates with these biblical covenants. So if you notice the Noah covenant, there's no end date to when God will stop being nice to people. There's no end date here when Abraham follows God's request, leaves his area, and goes to the land of Canaan. There's no end to that one either. All right, so there's Genesis 12. We're going to go to 16 and 17 next. Abraham, there's a repetition, by the way, in 15. Maybe I should back up and have you take a look at that. Toward the end of chapter 15, verse 18, "The Lord made a covenant with Abram." And this time the covenant is not just, "I'll bless you, make a nation of you," but it tells you where that land is going to be. And of course, it's the land we associate today with the Middle East there. And so you can look it up if you care to with geography. But there's a covenant. And again, you notice it doesn't appear to have an end. So we're on our way here. We've got Abraham. He's married, has a wife, Sarai. Again, she will have a name change later on. I hope you notice how important names are. Hugely important. And we'll see that as we continue throughout the Bible. But we don't do as much today, do we, with names? We occasionally in class, I'll ask my students, does your name have a particular meaning to your family or to, you know, some language that they referred to? And I'll have some that'll say yes, but a lot of times people pick names because they sound good. And they like, it goes with their last name, for example. But boy, names are so important here in the Bible. All right, so we'll pick up with Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had a maidservant named Hagar, verse 2. So she says to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Now, before you say, "Wow, what a strange thing. What's wrong with her?" I'd like you to keep in mind that this actually was an ancient custom back then. So you did have other people that would do the same thing. If they couldn't have a child, they would have a maidservant be a stand-in, a surrogate parent in a sense. So that's what's going on here. But did you notice what the Bible is trying to suggest is that there was a promise that they would be, that they would have kids and be blessed, and Sarai or Sarah is getting desperate and wants to hurry up this plan and puts into effect her own plan. And so we're going to see again and again people that try to bypass in the Bible the way God says to do things, try doing things on their own, and they end up just messing things up. And this is going to be a huge mess up that we'll see with Abraham's family. And out of this relationship that Abraham has with Hagar, we see in verse 11, she's going to have a son. And that son is Ishmael. Now, why is that important? Well, Arabs trace their ancestry back to Abraham, as I said, as the Jews do. In their case, though, they look back at their lineage through Ishmael back to Abraham. The Jews go back through Isaac and then back to Abraham. So just keep in mind, it's a family deal, but you know how it is. Families can end up with some pretty horrific clashes. And so we get these two sons through Sarah and Hagar that are going to clash desperately. In fact, in verse 12, there's the promise, isn't there? In chapter 16, verse 12, he'll be wild, his hand will be against everyone, everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. And so there's the ominous promise of what's coming. There's going to be clashes, and the Bible's full of clashes, and especially family clashes. Okay, so let's pick up on 20. That's chapter 16. Oh, real quickly on 17. Do you notice mine is titled The Covenant of Circumcision? So as a way, in a sense, to demonstrate a visible sign of some contract that's being reached. Today, our visible sign would probably be a handwritten signature, maybe a seal of some kind, something like that visual that we would have to be able to hang on to. So back then, they did it, in this case, a visual sign for Noah. Remember, was what? For that covenant? Yeah, it was the rainbow. Here, the covenant is circumcision. Does that mean the Jews were the only ones that practiced circumcision? No. Again, that was widespread in the ancient world. But here, God is saying, we're going to make this as a sign, a reminder that you are part of my people and you're agreeing to follow on the covenant as set up. All right, so we've got chapter 17 with the sign. Let me skip over a couple. Let's go to 22. This is huge, isn't it? This is the famous testing of Abraham section. And here's what I'd like to do. I would like you to think, as you're reading through the rest of the Bible, I'd like you to think about the importance of imagination as you read the Bible. Well, in fact, the importance of imagination for any literature, but especially the Bible. Why especially the Bible? Because the Bible is full of understatement. It tends to leave a lot out. It's stripped down. It's very bare. It's pretty much just the essentials. Just the facts, ma'am. And so let me give you an example of where imagination might help you enter the scene, might help you visualize what's happening, and give you a far better reaction to the events that the Bible discusses. So we'll start off, chapter 22, first verse. God tests Abraham, says to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. God said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about." Early the next morning, it says, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And then they set out. Now that's it. What'd that take? 10 seconds to read? Something like that? 15 seconds? But imagination is so important. Let's take the first couple of verses again. God speaks to Abraham. Any thoughts about that? Use your imagination. All right, well, think about that. I don't know about you, but I try to imagine, what would that have been like? God spoke. Now, do we mean literally? Abraham's walking along and there's this voice. So is he alone when he hears this voice? How would you feel if you're walking along and you hear a voice and nobody's there? My guess is first thing I'd think of is, I am losing it. Time for a CAT scan. I'm in trouble. I got to go get this taken care of. Great. Some kind of brain problem. But Abraham just simply says, here I am. Well, he's dealt with God before, hasn't he? But again, I'm just left. I'm very curious. My imagination is such, I'd like to know what that voice was like. Is it a literal voice? Is it something in his head? Either way, I guess he knows enough by now to say, yeah, that's authentic. That's God's voice. Notice, as we continue, God speaks to him and says, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Now that seems pretty repetitive, doesn't it? Take your son. Well, Ishmael's long gone with, you know, his family and stuff. Take your son, your only son. Well, Abraham knows that too. And then he names him. God says Isaac, as if Abraham would say, oh, that one. And then God says, whom you love. That seems like four things that didn't need to all be said. Take your son, your only son, his name's Isaac, you love him, and go to this area called Moriah. So my question is, again, use your imagination, why would God say it that way? Any thoughts? I'll tell you my feeling, and then you may have another take on this, but my feeling is God wants this test to be as hard as possible, as if it's not hard enough to take your son up into a mountain and put him to death. But notice what he says, your only son. Wow. This is not a case where he's got 10 more at home, so hey, you know, I like Isaac, but 10 more, ready to go. Your only son, and then the name, Isaac. Right? So they actually remember that name, remember that when he was conceived, and remember when the name came out, and all that kind of stuff, right? That's important. That ties you into that child. The child has a name. And this is whom you love, right? So it's not just a son that you're clashing with. This is the son of your dreams. This is the one who's the son of promise. That's the son of love. So God reminds them, wow, talk about putting the screws to Abraham. And then one other place in here that I think you could use your imagination on is verse 3. Interesting. As I said, the Bible's understated, but it says there early the next morning he did all of this. Any thoughts on that? Early the next morning. Why would they bother to tell you that piece of information? Well, I'll tell you my thought again. A little hard in MP3 format here to hear what you're thinking. But my thought is that Abraham has probably not told Sarah. Notice she's not in here anyplace. And I think you can understand that. If you know moms, if you've been around a mom lately, moms are so protective of their kids. I mean, think about these big, hulking, bruising fullbacks on a football team or defensive tackles or something when they've crushed people and they get the camera on them and talk to them. They say, hi, Mom. And so the moms have a special relationship with their kids. They bore them. They went through the pain. They nursed them. They've kept them close to them. They've rocked them to sleep. And now you think Abraham is going to go to Sarah and say, well, I got a busy day tomorrow. Got to take our son, right, the one that you had all the pain and the agony and the joy of giving birth to. Say, I'm going to take him up to the hills and put him to death. Oh, no. I don't think so. So he gets out early in the morning. And again, I'm reading into this. I realize that. But that's what you want to do, too, as you read through this material. Put yourself there. Imagine you're Abraham or imagine you're Sarah. And there he is, scuttling around in the morning and getting out of there before Sarah can get up and say, what are you up to? All right, so that's chapter 22. Let's move to 25. We have here Abraham dying. We have his son Isaac. who now we enter the account of Isaac in chapter 25, verse 19, it starts, and we find out about the two sons. Isaac is not a very interesting character. There's not a lot with Isaac, but the two sons are hugely important. So we pick up in 19, and we get twins that are going to be born to Isaac's wife, Rebekah. And the two twins, notice there's a, let's see, the Lord says to Rebekah in verse 23, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. And the older will serve the younger, it says. That's the key part I wanted you to look at. We'll see that throughout the Bible. The older will serve the younger. Again and again, it's not going to be the oldest son. Now, what's the big deal about that? Well, in that culture, the oldest son was the primary beneficiary, right? That's the one that got the blessings. That's the one that got the inheritance. And so the Bible, in a sense, is saying God is not predictable. God will not do things that humans would do. God will go past the obvious. So keep looking for that. How many times are we going to see the older will serve the younger? The most obvious, the best choice, the one that people will go to first is not going to be the one that God is actually going to work with. And notice it says, actually, two nations are in your womb. So we're going to get not just two brothers, but again, these are hugely important because they're going to sire two groups of people. And we'll see how that turns out. Well, these two are Jacob and Esau. And did you see my note here? My Bible says Esau may mean hairy. All right, so this is a man of the earth. This is a down-to-earth, hairy, rough, tough hunter kind of guy. My Bible also says, as you'll see later on, he's called Edom. That's in verse 30. Well, Edom means red, but it means way more than that. Edom is going to become, if you read through the rest of the Old Testament, it's going to become a nation close to Israel, but implacable enemy. They're going to clash constantly with the Israelites and be a tremendous thorn in their side. And we're going to see where all of that started. So here are the two that are born. We get Esau, we get Jacob. And notice, by the way, the birth is a very foreshadowing, symbolic kind of thing. Verse 26, Esau's born first, and then his brother came out. His hand is grasping Esau's heel. And verse 26, my footnote says, the word Jacob is important. He grasps the heel. Why grasping the heel? He deceives, or he trips up. And so we've got Jacob, who's going to be a treacherous kind of guy. And what's interesting is how Jacob ends up as the story develops here. So it says they grew up. Esau's a hunter. He's a man of the country. He's, as I said, he's very earthy. Jacob is quiet. He stays among the tents. So there's some tension, isn't there, right there? Isaac, now that's the dad, loves eating wild food, wild game. And so, of course, Esau's his favorite. Esau brings in the food. Rebekah loves Jacob. Now, that's not going to be great for a family, is it, to have favoritism? We'll see favoritism rear its head several more times in the Bible. And then comes the scene that is crucial, and I like this scene because I think the dialogue, which you realize is so important in stories, does an effective job here. So in verse 29, once when Jacob was cooking some stew, so he's around home, here comes Esau. He's been out in the country. He's famished. He says to Jacob, now listen to the language coming out of Esau's mouth. Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. Do you notice how the dialogue reveals his character there? It's just no nonsense. It's not kind. It's, I want to eat. Let's go. I'm famished. Here's a person of earthy appetites, right? He wants to satisfy his appetites. So Jacob says, being the schemer, remember he's the deceiver, the schemer, first, sell me your birthright. Now, what's a birthright? Birthright is what the father would pass to the son, all the blessings, all of the favoritism. The firstborn was always supposed to have that. And normally Esau should say, oh no, this is really important, right? This is from God. It's a blessing from God to be channeled through my father's. No way I'm selling that for stew. And Esau says instead, look again at the dialogue. Look, I'm about to die. What good's the birthright to me? Talk about short-sighted. He'd rather take care of his stomach than get a blessing from God. And so he swears an oath, actually swears an oath, giving up his birthright. And then he eats and he drinks, and he leaves. So that's Esau. He wants instant gratification, here and now, rather than some kind of future blessing. Does that sound familiar? A lot of people in our society are instant gratified people. Take care of it in the moment. Max that credit card. Worry about paying it off some other time. Well, we get the story, which I think I will skip over here. But Jacob tricks his dad. Eventually he gets the blessing and has to flee because Esau is so angry. So I want to pick up, if that's okay, in chapter 29. Jacob has left the family. Esau is ready to kill him. So he's hiding out among his mother's relatives. And remember, he's the trickster. So this is an interesting chapter. The trickster is going to get tricked. So let's pick up in chapter 29. He falls in love in verse 9. He meets this woman, Rachel. And it's the daughter of Laban. And that's his mom's brother, Laban. So he sees Rachel and he goes, wow, this is a woman. I want to marry her. Now, in the chapter, you're going to see Rachel has an older sister. Now, so here we go again, an older sister. She should be the one that gets married first, but no, her name is Leah. The younger sister is Rachel. And then the Bible says something very strange that doesn't really flesh it out very well. So chapter 29, verse 17. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. And so he's in love with Rachel, not Leah. And he says, I'll work 7 years. That's going to be my dowry, right? I'll pay in 7 years of work if you'll give me Rachel. So Laban says, okay. So he works 7 years. And can you imagine, as it got near the end of the 7 years, Rachel is ripened. She's a beautiful woman now. And he's excited to marry her. And in verse 21, just a note to the guys in here. This is probably what you don't want to say to your future father-in-law. Jacob says to Laban, give me my wife. My time is completed and I want to lie with her. Yeah, that's probably not going to be a real effective way to win over a father-in-law, huh? Especially if they have guns. So anyway, that's so they have a feast, right? They're going to get, the wedding's going to take place. And then, guess who gets tricked? Jacob, verse 23. When evening came, right? So apparently they did the ceremonies in the evening there. He took his daughter Leah. Now who? Leah. And gave her to Jacob. And Jacob lay with her. And when morning came, in verse 25, I love that. This is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. When morning came, there was Leah. And Jacob, of course, rushes off to Laban and says, hey, what's going on? You know, I wanted Rachel. But let's go back. That's a great scene. Use your imagination again. Let's think about that. I think, by the way, that's an awfully funny piece in the Bible. People always say the Bible has no humor. You know, God has no sense of humor. This is funny. And we'll find a lot of funny things as we go through the Bible, or you will. There are plenty of places where there's humor. That's part of life. Tragedies and comedies. I just think it's great seeing a trickster get his own tricking slap back at him here. All right, so let's pick up on that. Use your imagination. Leah is substituted for Rachel. Any thoughts on that? How do you have a wedding ceremony and not know, if you're Jacob, not know that you just married the wrong woman? Any thoughts on that? Well, my feeling again, if it's evening, it's dark, right? And so you have some, I guess, fires going and things like that. And my guess again is if you picture women of that time being wrapped and having head cloths and things like that. Maybe there's something over the face as well. Maybe she didn't have to say very much. Okay, well, that's the first part of the problem, or that's the first puzzle to think about. And of course, the other one is, he goes in and spends the night with her and doesn't discover the mismatch until morning. So here's question number two. How do you spend a whole night with a woman and not realize it's the wrong one? Okay, I don't think I'm going to go too far down that road. I'll let you think about that one. again, I got some ideas, but I'm going to let that go and let you figure that one out. Then we have a third situation, which I think is awfully funny. When morning came, there was Leah. Use your imagination. Remember what we heard about Leah before? What was the only physical feature that we heard about her? She had weak eyes. So here's my picture of this scene. Jacob has spent a wonderful night, and he's all cozy and he's relaxed, and this warm body is next to him in the morning, and he turns over, and they're probably, you know, covered all up, except maybe just the top half of the face or something. And he looks over, and this woman feels him stirring and opens her eyes, and he looks into those weak eyes. I don't know. I don't know what that meant. It could be just the color, but maybe they were watery, or maybe there's something weird about them. And so that's what he looks into in the morning. Can you imagine what his reaction must have been? I bet his heart rate hit 200. And I bet he bounded out of that tent mighty, mighty fast to go ask Laban, what's the deal here? So I just thought that was a funny scene. You can read the rest of that story there. At the end of 29 and in chapter 30, we see where some problems are going to come and some interesting names that will be associated with Jacob. He's now got a second wife because he does eventually get Rachel. You can read how that works out. And he loves Rachel, doesn't care that much for Leah. But again, there's a inversion of what we might expect. Rachel doesn't get to have any kids. But Leah is just coming up with one after the next. And I'd like you to keep in mind these names of the kids and see if they sound familiar to you. She bears him Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. And eventually, there's some other kids that come out of relationships, including servants and finally Rachel. But we get others. These are the other children of Jacob. One named Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, and then Rachel gives birth to Joseph. And finally, there's one more in the next, I think it's chapter 35, Benjamin. So there are 11 sons here, and one more in chapter 35. There are 12 sons. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, good. These are the 12 tribes of Israel eventually. So each tribe is going to be named after one of these sons. Okay, well, I'm going to jump the story for just a minute because you're going to say, I don't remember a tribe of Joseph in the land. That's right. Joseph is going to have two of his own sons and asks that they take his place. Well, now that's, if we take 12 minus Joseph, that's 11, but we put in two of his sons, that's 13. And you scratch your head and go, well, we don't have 13 tribes. Again, you're right. That tribe of Levi is going to become a priestly tribe, and they will not be given a portion of the land. So you have to subtract Joseph and Levi and plug in Joseph's two kids, Manasseh and Ephraim. We'll talk about those a little bit later. Okay, so does that make sense as far as the tribes of Israel? Chapter 32, just one short part here. This is, see if I can find it here. Oh, here we go. Chapter 32, Jacob wrestles with God. I won't focus on that, but Jacob wants a blessing. And in chapter 32, verse 26, Jacob says, you have to bless me. And the man says, what's your name? He says, Jacob. And then verse 28, the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel. Okay, let's go down here. Israel, do you have a definition on that? It's not, he won't be known as deceiver anymore. He won't be known as somebody who grasps the heel. He's now going to be known Israel. E-L at the end, you recognize that as a name for God, like Elohim, El Shaddai. So part of it's God. The whole phrase Israel means he struggles with God. Is that a perfect name or what? If you think about Israel, meaning the people as a whole, the land of Israel, hasn't that been the case ever since then for 3,000 or 4,000 years? They struggle with God. It's a constant struggle. So appropriate name again. I'm going to pick up over on 37. This is the last part of Genesis, and this is the focus on one of Jacob's children, Joseph. And again, you probably know the story pretty well. I wanted to point out at the beginning of 37 how immature Joseph seems. Do you see that? He's a favorite son. He knows he's a favorite son. His dad, Israel, Jacob, says loves him more than any of his other sons. And so he makes him this beautiful robe and has all this stuff for him. And then Joseph has a dream, and he tells his brothers the dream. Now, I want you to think about this. How is this for ignorance or immaturity here? Listen to this dream I had. Hey, guys, you want to hear my dream? We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose, stood upright. Your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. His brothers say, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And then he has another dream. Hasn't he caught on? This is not the kind of stuff you want to tell your brothers about. But in verse 9, listen, he says, I had another dream. And this time the sun and moon and 11 stars. Who are the 11 stars? Brothers. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he wonders why the brothers are not real fond of him. I mean, right off, they're not fond because the dad loves him. So these 11 feel kind of out of it anyway. Well, they're going to cook up a plot, and you know the story. Verse 19 of chapter 37, they say, here comes that dreamer when they're out in the fields, and they plot to kill him. And in the plot, I want you to notice something. Reuben tries to break this up. He doesn't want this to happen. Why is Reuben the one involved? Because he's the oldest son. And the oldest is supposed to be in charge, right? But watch what happens as the story develops. It's Judah. In verse 26, it says, come, let's sell him and not lay our hands on him. It won't be blood on our hands. And the brothers agree. So, do you see subtly what's happening here? Reuben is losing control of the brothers, and it will never be Reuben again. It'll always be Judah, and more and more stories about Judah. And of course, I'm sure you've heard about the tribe of Judah. It's a very important tribe. It'll tie in even into New Testament times. So we see the Joseph story. He starts out immature, and he's, given a terrible life as a slave. And we're going to skip over a little bit more here. He gets thrown into jail, in prison, because he's been unjustly accused of rape. So he's got two other people in prison with him. The cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt had offended the king, I guess, and end up chucked into the same prison with him. And so they have dreams while they're in prison. And Joseph says, I'm close to God. God interprets dreams. Why don't you tell me your dreams? So these two tell him the dreams. And he tells the first person, which is the cupbearer. So the cupbearer tells him a dream, and Joseph interprets it. He says, within 3 days, verse 13, chapter 40, within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. Wow. Good news, huh? So the cupbearer had a dream, and it's going to turn out very well for him. Pharaoh will lift up your head. You won't have to have your head down. He will, in a sense, put his hand under your chin and say, you can look at me. It's okay. We're compadres again. Now, that was good news. So can you imagine the baker? Again, use your imagination. What do you think the baker is coming up with? Well, he's figuring, well, that's good news. I had a dream that's pretty similar. And so he says to Joseph, hey, let me tell you my dream. So he does. And then Joseph says, this is what it means. Verse 18, the three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift. Now, I'm going to stop here for just a second. Can you imagine what was coming through at that point to the baker? He's thinking, great, I'm hearing the same message. Pharaoh will lift up my head. I'm going to be okay. Oh, no. Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree, and birds will eat away your flesh. Not good, huh? But do you hear that there's, a play on words there? Lift up your head or lift off your head. One is a whole lot worse than the others. Well, what we're encountering there is a biblical device that's used often, and we'll come across it again and again, of puns that are plays on words, in a sense. And I love puns, and so you're going to have to put up with some here. I want to give you some puns to have you think about it. They're in our culture. I think, actually, they're very imaginative, and they're creative, and they require that you understand language, and they're, in a sense, a test of language. If you groan, they always say the test of a good pun is if people groan. So if you groan, you probably got it. if you scratch your head, it means you didn't pick up on the literary reference or the actual definition of the word or something like that. So, you ready? Let's do a couple of biblical puns. Who is the most popular actor in the Bible? Samson. Why is that? He brought down the house. All right, I won't even explain that one. I'll let you find that one out on your own. Let's see. Let me see if I can find. I'm looking through some different things here. There's one that. Okay. Where is tennis first played in the Bible? When Joseph served in Pharaoh's court. All right. Are you groaning yet? Okay. How about from the New Testament? In Matthew, Jesus turns to Peter and he says, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." Now, we look at it in English, we go, "I don't get it," just a nice statement. Well, you got to know the Greek. "Thou art Peter," that's Petros, "and upon this rock, Petra, I will build my church." So do you hear the pun going on there? Let's do some puns that are not necessarily from the Bible. You know what? I'm going to skip some of those. Oh, here we go. Two antennas met on a roof, fell in love, and got married. The ceremony wasn't much, but the reception was excellent. All right, how about this one? A jumper cable walks into a bar. The bartender says, "I'll serve you, but don't start anything." Another man walks in bar joke. Man walks into a bar with a slab of asphalt under his arm, says, "A beer, please, and one for the road." Got it? Okay. Two Eskimos are sitting in a kayak. They got cold, so they lit a fire. Well, that wasn't smart. Right? Unsurprisingly, it sank, and it proved the old saying, "You can't have your kayak and heat it too." Wow. Okay. How about some more bar jokes? A neutron goes into a bar and asks the bartender, "How much for a beer?" The bartender replies, "For you, no charge." Two atoms. I guess these are physics, physics puns. Two atoms are walking down the street and they run into each other. One says to the other, "Are you all right?" "No, I lost an electron." "Are you sure?" And the second atom says, "Yeah, I'm positive." Okay. Any more? You still with me? Hello? Don't leave. How about this? You hear about the sumo bank? Yeah, it went belly up. How about the sushi bank? It got a raw deal. Did you hear about the origami bank? The origami bank? It folded. All right. A few more? Are we okay? All right. Let's try, how about three or four more? I thought I saw an eye doctor on an Alaskan island, but it turned out to be an optical illusion. She was only a whiskey maker, but he loved her still. A dog gave birth to puppies near the road and was cited for littering. Atheism, you almost have to see this one. Atheism is a non-profit organization, but profit is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, a non-profit organization. Okay. Well, anyway, that gives you an idea, right? So before you come find me and beat me about the head, those are puns, and we're going to see them often in here. Let's continue with the story in Genesis 41, chapter 41. Here's the reference I think I mentioned to you before about the sons that Joseph had, and that's toward the end of chapter 41, Manasseh in verse 51, and in 52, Ephraim. So we're going to see on the maps, if you look, in the 12 tribes, Manasseh will be given a territory, and so will Ephraim, but Joseph will not, and Levi will not. So that's where we are with the 12 tribes there. Does that make sense? Chapter 42. I've already mentioned the use of dialogue. And I think dialogue does such a wonderful thing. People tend to skip over it and just look at, you know, the plot of the story. But oftentimes, dialogue gives us so much information. It's so rich. And it is here. Let's start in chapter 42. There's trouble in Palestine or the Holy Land, Canaan, because there's a famine and only Egypt appears to have food. And so I love what Jacob says in verse 1. He learns that there's grain there. He says to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other? I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so we may live and not die." Remember, he doesn't like them as well as he likes Joseph. That doesn't sound like a very kind thing. Why are you guys just sitting here staring at each other? Get a move on. Do something about it. But isn't that wonderful? I just love that use of language. Later on in the chapter, they are tricked by Joseph. And in verse 28, they say, "What is this that God has done to us?" Did you notice they don't say, "Hey, what's the explanation here? There's got to be something. Did somebody grab something?" But here's my thought, and you may agree or disagree. My thought is that they still feel guilty for what they did to Joseph. And so they feel that somehow God is punishing them. And if we go along, I want to show you dialogue one other time, which is chapter 45. Joseph finally reveals himself to them, tells them who he is. "I'm your brother." This is verse 4 of chapter 45. "I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here." Of course, they're thinking their history. He's going to take them out and do them in. But what does he say? "Don't feel bad, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." Did you hear that? It was all part of a plan, that this is not, there's no such thing in the Bible as just happenstance, right? God is working these things out. And he did it not to just play a joke on the brothers, haha, see, I've saved Joseph, but to save lives. So it was God doing it, not the brothers, and this all turned out for the good here. So I think that's a major theme, a theme of the whole Bible, but certainly a theme of the Joseph story here. And by the way, Egypt is a big part of the Bible, isn't it? Oftentimes, people go to Egypt when they're in trouble, and then they get themselves even in worse trouble. So Egypt is a place to go to thinking that it'll be some kind of salvation, and it does not turn out to be. So keep looking for that as you continue through the Old Testament. Let me take you to chapter 50, the last chapter of Genesis, especially toward the end. The last few verses, we get the death of Joseph, and there's some foreshadowing going on. Now, here's Joseph, and he's invited his family, and Pharaoh is beaming and happy with all of this stuff. So we've got a lot of people have moved to Egypt now. And verse 24, Joseph says in his last speech to the brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So he makes the sons of Israel swear an oath and say, God will come, and you've got to take me out of here as well. And so he dies. And interestingly enough, in 26, it says that he was embalmed and placed in a coffin. So apparently that's, you know, if they carried him out years later, my guess is he still looked fairly good. But do you see what's said there? There's a foreshadowing, isn't there, that you don't want to stay here. You need to get out. And right then, I'm sure they're saying, why would we get out? Life's good. Got God on our side, and the Pharaoh likes us. Okay, but you'll see when we start Exodus next time, verse 8 of the very first chapter says, there was a new king who did not know about Joseph and came to power. So things changed, and Joseph has foreshadowed that and made them promise to take him out of the land as well. And that's what we'll look at next time, the story of Exodus.